Hello and welcome to the A versus A podcast. I'm Benjamin.
And I'm Nick.
And we are returning from a rather long summer sabbatical. We still have a couple of episodes in the can from the talking about Scott McCloud. And so those are coming up, and I promise you that they will happen. But for now, there's what we wanted to discuss was the Mythicist Milwaukee Conference and some of the things around that. Why don't you kick off that discussion, Nick?
Well, Ben and I have an interesting perspective on it, because as you may well know, if you've been following it at all, prior to the conference, there was a bit of a hullabaloo in terms of a group of people who very much didn't want the conference to happen, or at the very least, they wanted the conference to deplatform three of the special guests who were speaking at the conference, that being Gregory Fleurer, also known as the Armored Skeptic, and June Lapine, I can't think of her last name.
Sounds Siobhan like Bunny, Heck. Which is why she's obsessed with bunnies, I guess.
Okay. But June Lapine, who's Shoe on Head, and then Carl Benjamin, a.k.a. Sargon of Akkad, who's really pretty much the main target of a particular camp of individuals who, at least at this moment, by name would be Christy Winters, Steve Shives, and then a small group of others, including one particular individual who just annoys me just because I call him the king of context. His name is Michael Rollins. He's an Australian SJW. But there's a YouTuber and kind of social networking guy. I think he's got a Twitter presence and whatever. But what makes it interesting for both Ben and I to have a discussion about this is that I went to MythCon Milwaukee. I was there. And I got my VIP ticket so that I could hang out all day and I could go to the after party and have a chance to talk to Shu and Skep and Sargon. And then in addition to my presence there, Ben also had an opportunity to talk to one of the notables who withdrew in advance, named Seth Andrews, also known as the Thinking Atheist.
Who runs the Thinking Atheist channel. He hates it when people refer to him as the Thinking Atheist.
Well, see, you would know that and I wouldn't. All I know is that he's had a podcast and a radio show for a decade or more at this point. Maybe you could tell us a little about Seth Andrews for a sec, and then we could talk about the uproar, at least before the MythCon.
Okay, so just a brief bit of history. Seth Andrews is a gentleman who worked in Christian radio for a long time. So he was an established radio personality on a popular nationwide Christian channel. And then in his mid-30s, I guess, he started questioning Christianity and became an atheist and took a little while. He was kind of a closet atheist for a while he was still at the radio station and, you know, trying to figure out how to get out of his job and the Christian community and, you know, be able to make money and have a living and all those things. And as a result of that, he started the Thinking Atheist podcast. And as I mentioned, this comes up and he talks about it. You know, he is not the Thinking Atheist. He's the guy that, you know, took 35 years to figure out that believing in talking animals and, you know, a floating zoo and all these things were ridiculous. So he launched a channel as a way to appeal to atheists to continue thinking and questioning and learning. So that's why I bring that up. But I've been listening to him essentially since the beginning, you know, since he launched the channel, launched the podcast. And I really appreciate that he brings, in general, a friendly, nuanced, well-thought-out approach to most issues, including things like we've talked about on the podcast before, like trigger warnings and safe spaces and things like this. And I if you're not familiar with that one, audience, I would really recommend listening to that episode, and I will throw a link up in the podcast notes.
Right. So now what's the debacle? So
essentially,
well, if you want to go ahead, you can give that a shot.
Well, Seth Andrews decided that he would not be taking part in the Memphis-Milwaukee debate, and he has, which I will also put a link to, he put up a long written discussion on why he was withdrawing his name, his speech, his presence, and his participation, to quote, from the 2017 Misinformation Conference. And right. Essentially, it wasn't so much that he was withdrawing from the conference as, or even the reasons why, that, you know, he doesn't believe, well, the reasons that he gave of Arbid Skeptic, he doesn't believe is a really serious voice, as it were, you know, that essentially he doesn't address. But he had no actual complaints when he was talking about Shoe on Head. His only point of contention, apparently, with her, you know, other than her being a YouTube personality, was that she called the Black Lives Matter movement a bunch of black supremacists. You know, that it was black supremacist garbage, and he still supports BLM. But his biggest ire was centered around Carl Sargon Benjamin, and this one particular clip that was lifted out of one of Sargon's videos, where essentially there was a girl and her mother that were talking about how you shouldn't use.
It wasn't her mother. It was an actress.
Okay.
I believe it was a couple of actresses. The woman, I can't remember the actress's name. Let's see.
I read it as the girl's mother, which, you know,
let me break in here, because, like, you've got it, but I think that there's some stuff in there that I kind of researched that I've known about. So basically, what had happened is I brought up Christy Winters, Steve Shives, a few of these other people. They sort of form this contingent that are very pro social justice. Christy Winters is a professor in sociology. She's had some major criticisms online of the sort of anti-SJW group. So basically, what we're looking at are sort of ideological factions. And, you know, full disclosure, I tend to lean towards the anti-SJW. I have some very strong opinions in regards to Western culture and, you know, what is and isn't important. And it's not something I arrived at easily. You might say that I was kind of more on the social justice side before such a thing was named as such, at least popularly. And I definitely saw certain needs for certain things in society. But as I get older and I see how these things don't work, close up, far away, the big picture and the small picture, I keep seeing the flaws, and I'm like, okay, these are not simply side effect flaws, like, okay, capitalism has a tendency to appeal to greed, and so greedy people tend to do fairly well, but you can keep it in check if you just are aware of it. No, it's not a side effect flaw. They're like fatal flaws. They're like undermining fatal flaws that, you know, we could do a whole episode on that. I think we have.
Yeah. Yeah. And about how a lot of people on that side tend to frame it as, if you disagree with our tactics, then you must disagree with our principles. That
right.
Like, if you say anything against the idea of us deplatforming and even committing, like, violence, the bike lock attacker, for one, if you disagree with that, then apparently you are a chauvinist and a Nazi.
There are no bad tactics. There are only bad targets. And that undermines the very notion of civility in my mind. Like, no, there are bad tactics. There are ways you should not go about things. If you wish to be civil and have a discussion, you have to leave fighting and violence off the table. The only time violence and fighting are on the table is in self-defense. and maybe the defense of another, or to stop something calamitous, which would end up in death and dismemberment of human beings, et cetera. Like, you know, like in a sad case, maybe hypothetical, but you've got a person who's, you know, driving a bulldozer into a crowd and they're crazy. And the only way to stop them, you can't talk them down. You can't pull them out. You can only hit them with a sniper rifle, and then they'll drive the bulldozer away, or it'll stop functioning, something saving the crowd. There are, you know, it's the last resort violence, but you know, we are dealing with people who think that violence is okay because they're losing the argument, or because they can't figure out a way to do it in a better way. They can't beat the system by making a better one, however you want to look at it. But I'm trying to find...
Well, some of them, you know, I kind of feel bringing this up again, this speech, the Stranger Things guy who talked about, we are going to joyously punch these people in the face because they're monsters. You know, some of them, it's not that they see violence as a last resort because they've lost the debate. Some of them really seem to relish the idea of hunting down and physically assaulting Nazis. They have glorified this idea of Nazi hunting in modern 21st century America.
Okay, so to get back to the point, before, because I found my source, before the MythCon conference, Mythicist Milwaukee. So ostensibly a number of people were invited to speak. Shu, Skeptic Sargon, but also Melissa Chen, Matt Dillahunty was there to mediate
moderate a debate between
Faisal Saeed Al-Muttar, I think I got the name right, I'm not sure, and Asra Nomani. Both of whom, Faisal is not a Muslim. I guess he was raised Muslim, but he was raised by very sort of, I guess, free-thinking parents, I guess maybe a way to put it, who said, figure it out on your own, son. And so he had an opportunity to be, while raised in the culture and raised by parents who had been Muslim or maybe are still Muslim, he was able to kind of come to his own point of view, but he's still... you know, still entrenched in the culture. I believe this is an accurate representation. If not, my apologies to Faisal. And then Asra Nomani, who does call herself a Muslim, but considers herself a reform Muslim. She's been a Trump voter. These are just some side things that went on. Aren't the main topic.
The video is up online now. We'll put a link to that as well. You can listen to all of the speakers.
Right.
So definitely worth the time, even if you don't want to go through the Sargon versus what's his name? Thomas Smith.
Yeah.
Argument.
Right. So, but yeah, there's 5.5 hours of it. It's definitely, if you are a podcast devourer, you've got plenty to devour. So you could, you don't need to watch the video. You could just. What I like to do is I like to set YouTube videos to 140p and then stream it, like that keeps me from chunking data, and then I just turn my phone screen down to the lowest setting and then say battery power. But you can get you could listen to the whole thing while you're at work or driving or whatever you choose to do with your podcast. But
playing
video games. Basically, so the stage is this. MythCon, Mythicist Milwaukee announces MythCon, announces their speakers, these three YouTubers, and your social justice set, who I've described, Christy and Steve and all these people, they have a problem with that. One thing that they have apparently done is that they called the Pabst Theater to try to get the three YouTubers in question deplatformed and kicked out of the venue. They don't want them there. When that was not successful, they engaged in a smear campaign trying to say they were Nazis. Well, they already thought they were Nazis. They already consider them to be the lowest of the low and reprehensible and awful people. And so they ostensibly tried to get Mythicist Milwaukee sort of shut down. They raised an alarm. It ended up not having the effect they desired, but did leave Mythicist Milwaukee having to hire extra security for the event. I can say, having been to the event, there was no need. It was, there were a few cops in on motorcycles outside. There were a bunch of security wanding us every time you went in and out of the event. You had to pull your keys and everything out of your pocket. It was a damn nuisance. And on top of that, all it did was raise the cost of putting on the convention for Mythicist Milwaukee. So at that level alone, it was a shit move, because ostensibly it was attempting to stop free speech. But in the hubbub, Aaron Ra pulled out. Now, Aaron Ra is a noted atheist. He is someone that is definitely has a lot of good things to say. If you have an interest in the discussion between atheism and religion, and you yourself are trying to break from religion, Aaron Ra is a great source. He's a smart man. He's been doing it. He's got a lot of great points. He's very much a science. I wouldn't say he's a scientist. He's a science.
I don't think he has gotten his degree yet. He's been working at it for a long time, but yeah. I don't know exactly where he is in his academic career.
But he knows more about it than your average bear. And his approach is, at least I haven't heard very many criticisms of his approach. And then he's no slouch when it comes to philosophy either. Although, there are some, philosophers are eternally arguing with one another. There's some really good videos you can see with him having discussions with a YouTube philosophy guy named Ozymandias Ramses. Who I think is very, very succinct and very well-spoken. So he was supposed to be there as a special guest because at the end of the evening, at the end of the day of the convention, they were going to screen a film called Jesus and Batman, or Batman and Jesus.
Batman and Jesus, I think.
Batman and Jesus.
Yeah.
And I watched the film. It was interesting. I myself... not as like I'm not a deconvert. I never was really converted to religion, or I was for a moment in my life and it didn't last very long. It didn't take, as it were, it washed right out because it's just not my native state. Because, like Faisal Saeed Al-Muhtar, I was raised with a very liberal upbringing and I didn't have it forced on me the way others do. And so,
I'd like to make a quick point,
which we'll
come back later to. And we talked about this before we started recording, and I just want to bring it up, that of all of the things – I was not at Mythicist Milwaukee. I listened to the 5.5-hour YouTube video, which I enjoyed.
Yeah,
but right. I just wanted to make the point that other than the Batman and Jesus video, it didn't seem like anything else that happened at the conference that was discussed had anything to do with the Jesus as myth point, which essentially is the point of the conference. It didn't seem like a mythicist conference.
It's the idea that goes with the name mythicist. Although I will say, I think the organizers and the group Mythicist Milwaukee might be suffering not from mission creep, but from they're a mythicist conference is a, if you want to be real uptight about it, to call it, well, a mythicist conference has to be about mythicism. It has to be about that particular stripe of questioning the existence of Jesus, whatever. It does kind of unnecessarily narrow the scope. I mean, when it comes down to it, they're an atheist group and they were holding an atheist convention of a stripe. And one of the things that are happening that has happened as a result of, sort of this ideological, I hate to use the phrase culture war, but I guess ostensibly it kind of is. But this sort of culture war that has erupted, it's erupted because of the nature of culture happening in addition to other issues like atheism versus religion, gaming, music, movies, like, you know, nothing in any particular culture is pure. And if there is a big old debate brewing underneath everything, you're going to have a hard time having a conference that's just about mythicism, much less simply about atheism. I mean, the atheism circuit has already had eruption of this well before Gamergate. There was the whole atheism plus that whole thing. I don't know what you would call it, elevator gate. All of that stuff that you can look up on your own. We could leave you notes, but, you know, we already tend to have sprawling notes. So I
want to make it quick. So when you say that you don't want to refer to it as a culture war, why? What is your reason for not?
Oh, just because that? I think that it is a little bit. It's in danger of hyperbole. I don't know how else to say it. It's like you get close to overinflating the problem, and I think that's kind of part of the nature of the problem. Most people day to day don't really give a rat fuck about, you know, what major ideas are being fought back and forth.
Yeah, it's single white men like us that tend to be drawn to this type of discussion.
Well, not even. I mean, even as a, you know, I know you're joking, but even then, I'd say most of the quote unquote single white men out there don't really fucking care, nor do the single white women, nor do the single black women, nor the married people, nor the black men, nor a lot of people are just mostly concerned with, you know, the things we're all concerned about, you know, paying the bills, getting food, getting to work on time, or finding a job, or whatever it is that your issues are. That the problem with the culture war really, it does stem from like media and whatnot. And then on the other hand, though, I guess that's why I'm loath to call it that, is because maybe there is something of a culture war going on, because it reaches from everything from, you know, this big issue that everyone seems to have with Trump, for or against, this big issue everyone's having at the moment with Hollywood. At the moment of this recording, there's some debacle, which we're not going to get deep into because we decided ahead of time not to do it, with Harvey Weinstein and sexual misconduct at the least, and possibly rape, depending on what stories are true. And, you know, there's a lot of discussion about it happening now, and it's still, you know, by the time you hear this, or maybe down the road, more will have come to light. But at the moment, it's still just a big ballyhoo going on, which may be true. And Harvey Weinstein certainly isn't seeming to duck out of the way. He seems to be the accusations seem to be sticking. So who knows what's up? Who knows what's up?
Yeah. But, and I didn't even want to get off on that particular can of worms, because to me, it still doesn't really feel like anything new. It's just another guy at the top of a media empire who's being dethroned. We talked about the idea of king killing, which is a lot of what it, but to me, the idea of referring to it as a culture war in some ways justifies the use of these type of guerrilla, you know, hit and run type tactics. You know, the idea that it ultimately what matters is winning and not how you win.
Well, and yeah,
we and have rules of warfare, but in general, even in actual wars, it tends to be, you know, the tactics are what you can get away with. And I think that's the reason why this debate is starting to, you know, the discussion, the debate is starting to degrade, is because both sides look at it as a war and that they can somehow win it.
I mean, I'm conflicted, and we're way off path here, but I do have to say I have a conflict with the concept, because on the one hand, I do have a tendency to think that the terms you choose to use and how you think of a thing will have a tendency to kind of determine the path that you choose. Like, you definitely have a tendency, if using very hostile language to describe a situation between you and another group that with whom you're having a disagreement, you're definitely, I agree with you on one respect, but then on the other respect, I'm a little loath to go there because I'm a little like, well, we do end up in this sort of territory of an idea that the left has, which I'm not entirely, I mean, once again, now we're talking about another podcast subject where the left kind of has this notion that if you can change the words, you can change the world. Like, but just by renaming things and changing the way you talk about them, you can somehow make things better. And I'm like, no, there is a very clear divide between material reality. The words we use to describe that, including the phenomenon, including the thoughts we have and the feelings we have. And then just changing the name to somehow it doesn't, like, you know, like I quote Ice Cube when he said, you know, calling me an African American, like everything is fair again. You know, like, well, like he's saying, like, just changing the name doesn't change the world. And so it's, yeah, it's way off topic. Don't want to get into the culture war talk. I mean, that's could be a fucking discussion for another podcast. But so,
but do you see that there is a point that I'm trying to get to here, and part of the point, well, I think too, at the base topic. Well, the thing is, I'd like to think that part of the reason for this podcast is that we try and delve a little deeper into the issues at hand.
Mm-hmm.
And in some ways, I think the combative nature of the sides of this discussion are part of the problem. And in some ways, part of this Mythos of Milwaukee debate. And I'd like to kind of touch on them briefly. So,
okay. Sorry, I have to say for the podcast, I podcast, I'm very casual, but I do it in my garage. My door's half open. And there was a guy who came by who likes to bump smokes with me and he wouldn't stop. So everyone gets to know that. So if that ever happens again, I'm just trying to take the burden off of Ben, because otherwise he's got to go back and edit everything. But so go ahead, Ben. You were saying there's some basic ideas, and I wanted to get at I didn't feel like our explication was finished, but go ahead and you discuss your ideas here that you want to get at about the basic issues.
And maybe it is that I'm a little too sensitive to this particular terminology, and part of it was that I was raised fundamentalist conservative Christian. And one of their go-to metaphors is the idea of the Christian soldier, and that they're constantly at war with the secular world. So
kind of a Christian version of jihad.
Very much so. I mean, you laughed, but no, there are some parts of the American Christian right movement that very much wants to. Yeah, we started to see a little bit with oh God, what do they call them? The guys that took over the Oregon Wildlife Reserve?
Oh yeah, the
Y'all Qaeda.
Was that Y'all Qaeda? Are you serious?
That was one of the nicknames. I don't know, but that was one of the nicknames.
I'm sure that was put on them. I'm sure that wasn't chosen, self-chosen.
Oh no, I.
But yeah, that's I can't remember the guy's name. Cliven Bundy's son.
Yeah,
I can't remember. Yeah, y'all can look that up. Y'all Qaeda.
That's kind of the point that I'm making. And if you ever watch Jesus Camp, which is a wonderful documentary, and how they start throwing around this rhetoric with very small children, you know, it's like 5 and 6 year old kids.
Anyone familiar
really,
with
it sets me off. And the fact that I don't want to miss this, because to me it's a very important point. And this isn't something that Seth said when I saw him in New York City. This is something that the leader of the New York City atheists brought up, is the idea that when Seth is actually talking about, you know, trying to be civil and reasonable with Christians, because that's how ultimately we're going to win them over to secularism.
Right.
By keeping the moral high ground. By using reason and logic. And the leader of the NYC atheists was like, well, we don't want to be too reasonable. Remember that you guys are our foot soldiers on the front lines here. We've got to – and he started going – and immediately myself and one other guy there just groaned very loudly. It's like, please do not – You refer to me as a foot soldier, you're immediately turning me off.
Fundamentally, there's a greater issue there too, and it's one that you can point at the tactics used by some of these social justice people. These very divisive tactics. Yesterday, so we're recording this on Saturday, October 14th, but yesterday was Friday the 13th. It happened to be Women Boycott Twitter, # Women Boycott Twitter Day. And it's just these very kinds of tactics, which are, first of all, that particular example is somewhat toothless, but there are other tactics they use, like shaming and blaming. And to do that, and I can see your point, because in addition to not being reasonable, not trying to win them over with argument, there's another subtle level which has to do more with how you heal breaches, whether you want to talk about the breach in America between, like, elements of the sort of white culture and the black culture, if you wish to put them that way, elements of, the divide between men and women in very, tough times like they're having down in Hollywood with Mr. Weinstein, or in any other such breach, is that the peaceful proponents of each side do far better to continue to coexist with each other and actually agree to disagree, and at times when you need to get work done or when you've got bigger fish to fry. But then, when the time comes around and you do have a discussion about it, actually have a dispassionate, reasonable discussion. I know that I've gotten a lot farther with people who are both racist white folks and black folks who have a tendency to look at whites through a very racial lens, and just start to break things down just simply by being in proximity, being friendly, and being the fella who goes, yeah, I don't know about all that. And actually put up a good argument without it. And I think there's a problem where we need a word besides argument, because just like people botch sort of, people who aren't interested in discussion and debate and the marketplace of ideas or whatever you want to call it, don't use the word theory, like the religious right has a tendency to use the word theory in its colloquial way, which means, just some cobbled together idea about something we can't prove. That's an interesting theory that you have there. And that's the sort of the colloquial usage, whereas the strict scientific usage of the word is actually quite austere and potent. It actually means, no, this is, we've got facts, observable phenomena, mathematical formula, datum, whatever, that show that over and over and over, this seems to be the case. And then you end up giving it a name, the germ theory of medicine, or Einstein's theory of relativity. It's something well sewn together, fairly bulletproof.
It is the most substantiated rung of scientific proof, and it's referred to as a theory in part because nothing is unquestionable in science.
Right.
You need much stronger evidence and much stronger reasoning the stronger a theory is. But a theory is the highest you can get. You don't graduate from a theory to being a fact.
Yeah.
So the
very same way, I'm sorry, I don't mean to cut you off, but in the very same way, I want to wrap this up.
Yeah.
The idea of an argument, like I've been thinking lately that we do need, it'd be nice if we had a better bag of words to pull out of. And the word argument, in terms of the way maybe Ben and I might approach things sometimes, is where we're using elements of argument in the form of debate. Like, I have an argument, I have to defend my argument. You have a counter argument, you defend your counter argument, and we go at each other's argument to try and poke holes in the actual thought. And then, of course, we have the colloquial version, which means sometimes what Ben and I do devolve into, which is actually just a quarrel. Just a, no, you shut up. No, you shut up.
Which might be entertaining from the sidelines, but it doesn't actually lead to anywhere as far as establishing who has better ideas.
But Ben and I do our best. But so getting back to it, I do agree with what you're saying about this Onward Christian Soldiers. And on the same token, this thing you saw at your conference in New York, Onward Atheist Soldiers, where you're like, whoa, no, wait a minute. Wait a minute. That's like,
and yeah, it was very nice to see Seth come on after that and be like, no, hold on. That's not where I stand on this. I do think that we want to, you know, look towards peaceful progress, and you know, we're not trying to demonize or vilify anybody. So
right. I want to dig into kind of what I think is a really, like, our angle as the A versus A podcast that we might have over a lot of other people. And that's just simply that I went to MythCon, and about the time, a little before the time I went to MythCon, Ben got to see and actually speak to Seth Andrews before, what was the name of the convention you went to in New York?
Well, the thing is, it was an event that was put on by the New York City Atheists, where Seth just came to talk, and he gave an update of one of the talks that he's done before, which was about the 80s Satanist fear-mongering.
Satanic panic?
The satanic panic, which is one of my favorite topics, both seriously and humorously, because there are some things about it that you can hardly believe people actually took some of these things seriously. But right. I went there ahead of time and got a chance for about an hour while he was setting up to just chat back and forth.
Okay, so we'll get into that in a minute, but I think we still need to set the tone, before we put the jewel of our discussion out. I need to kind of continue with the ring and the centerpiecing of it. And basically, so what we had MythCon Milwaukee, we had all these SJWs being very divisive and trying to rip the whole thing down. Sargon showed up, and we're not really going to get into that. That is well trammeled territory. That's all over YouTube and whatever. But the point is that before the conference, and this was something I noticed, Seth Andrews was a special guest who was ostensibly, I think, going to say a few words and otherwise just sit and watch.
Not initially.
No, initially, what do you remember? I thought he was just going to be.
What I understand, he was invited as a special guest, which, you know, was just someone who was there to attend the premiere of Batman and Jesus. Yeah. And then he found out about Shu and Skeptic and Sargon. So he sent his. And at that point, they offered him the chance to, you know, say a few words. And he's like, there's no point to this because all I would do is just start railing against how this was done and against his perception of Sargon as essentially a troll.
Okay. And so part of the issue here, and I think part of the major issue that doesn't really get discussed, is that MythCon Milwaukee, outside of sort of, in my opinion, a stickler's argument that it's not about mythicism anymore. I'm like, yeah, well, it's an atheist convention in general. And of course, it's not going to survive as a con, you know, like unless suddenly mythicism gets at least as popular as knitting.
But there I only know a few people within the academic community who are even seriously pursuing.
Yeah. I mean, at which point, I think they had Bart Ehrlman and a few other people of
Richard,
like,
Carrier. Yeah.
Yeah. It's dry as unbuttered toast for most people. And and if you're going to have a convention over it and you're going to go to Pabst, so like some of the like Matt Dillahunty kind of did a video about his take on the whole Mythicist Milwaukee thing, the MythCon. And I think there is a point to be made that maybe they didn't represent themselves well. I think that it's a little, how do I put it? It's a little presumptuous to presume that they were being intentionally misinformative. I think really what it is that they were trying to do something, and maybe there was a little bit of misunderstanding among the leadership. I think if you want to have a nice dry mythicist convention, I think you're going to, you might find a little hall off the side of a Howard Johnson's in the middle of nowhere and you'll get your 12 people to show up, and that's great. I think that if your desire is to pull in a lot of people into, kind of have a bit more of the profile of a big convention. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I think that there's already, like, I mean, TAM has been huge. There's been other atheist conventions that have been huge. The atheist movement itself, whether they ever openly spoke upon it or not, was energized by the amount of people. So this is not an ad populum argument.
That first one in D.C. was really popular.
And there's a precedent for that. And I think that there's nothing wrong with people saying, let's fan the fires. Let's get this into a discussion in the public, you know, and you're never going to get public discussion about it if it can't trend at least, you know, in the top 100 on Twitter. So, you know, we had a discussion, Ben and I, before the podcast, and there was a bit of a it was about a different topic, but I think the notion of the ad populum fallacy came up, and I wanted to point out that, you know, I don't think there's anything not good about wanting something to be popular if you care a lot about the topic. Now, I think you can go about it the wrong way, and there's been some criticism, especially by like Matt Dillahunty, about whether they went about it the right way. I don't know. I really think that depends on what your goal is as a sort of commentator or critic, what you think the goal should be. You can go and watch Matt Dillahunty's video. I think that is definitely something we should put in the show notes.
Yeah, I've added a link to that in the show notes already. I thought it was particularly well thought out, insightful, honestly.
Yeah, it was. But having been at MythCon and having had my perspective on it, I'd have to say that MythCon has branched out. And I think part of the reason why they involved Skep Shu and Sargon is simply because they're part of a greater cultural discussion that, whether one likes it or not, is infecting conversations about atheism and conversations about religion. I think that if we were having a great debate about cake versus pie, I think you'd have an infection of this quote unquote culture war. I guess maybe it also, to look back on what we just talked about the culture war, Ben, I guess another thing I'd say is I'm loath to call it that. But part of the reason why I'm loath to call that is because I think it already is, kind of. And I think that it has to do with just the very wild adherence of each side. I mean, you go to the far left with the social justice regressive, or to the far right, you've got people bring up the alt-right a lot, but they're by no means the only players. They're by no means the only people on the far right who are fanning the flames of a kind of a pit fight over how we are in our world.
Well, part of this is that, unfortunately, when I start to get into political discussions, it can be difficult for me to remain civil about it and to not get heated. And in my mind, part of it is I want to avoid that tendency in myself, because I know that that doesn't lead to rational discussion. And it doesn't convince anyone. It just drives people away, which I was seeing myself just recently getting into a political discussion. And it was the whole Bernie versus Hillary debate, which is still raging in some parts of. And I just saw a friend of mine who I hadn't seen in years was starting to like sidle away because he wanted to hang out. But if I'm getting engrossed in this, hammer and tongs discussion, doesn't want any part of that.
I do have to say, though, that frankly, that is a, I mean, from my perspective, it is beholden upon you to keep the peace personally. That if you are someone who's going to get really upset when you're having a discussion that ought to be rational, it's you who are failing the discussion, not the other way around. You know, it's like if you're losing your shit about it because it's an emotional hot point for you, then you shouldn't get in those discussions, or B, maybe work on your approach, because, you know, in a way, it's kind of part and parcel of why sort of the anti-social justice perspective exists, is because so many conversations get shut down because the social justice side says, well, I'm triggered, you can't talk about that. It hurts me emotionally. I freak out about it. I'm like, well, then maybe you need to go to your safe space and let the big people talk. And, you know, I'm not gunning on you. That did slide in that direction. but you're not that way, and I know that clearly. We talk about a lot of heavy hitting issues.
Well, and I do realize that I need to curb my emotionality around these things, and the whole idea that, you know, of the tone policing, that, you know, your people are justified in flying off the handle because how dare you police my feelings around it? It's no. At some point, when you're an adult, you need to divorce your feelings from the argument and focus it on it coldly, objectively, and rationally, or you're not going to reach a reasonable decision.
Right.
We are prone to that as humans, and we need to avoid that tendency.
Yeah, and it can be hard. It can be hard, but in the very same way, I think that's kind of why so many atheists do put on this demeanor of rationality and say, no, this is how we must be. Because I think so many of them have suffered under the fucking emotional bullying and the torment of like that hellfire and brimstone kind of impassioned argument from their religious. I mean, a lot of people who are deconverts, unfortunately, like you said, you have. I think a lot of them, from everyone I've met, grew up in this hostile atmosphere of sort of like this extreme, intense emotional torment. And that doesn't ever get you anywhere, but mentally broken or totally psycho, like at each extreme. So
I hate to say this because it seems like we've barely broached upon what Nick sees as the actual jewel of it. And we are coming up on the hour mark, and I am inclined to just say, OK, we're coming back from the break. Let's just go for it. You know, there might be a few of our normal channels that the video is going to be a little long, or the audio is going to be a little long for them. But I'm inclined to just let this one slide. And
yeah. Well, if most of you are listening to this on SoundCloud, Ben, can we get this on SoundCloud?
Yeah. It's not a problem with SoundCloud. It's some of the other podcast carriers that, you know, that have increments of an hour in the amount of videos that you can or audio that you can upload on a free account.
Right. So for all of our non-SoundCloud listeners, I'm sorry if we're pissing you off, but this is our coming back from the break special. It's going to be a little long, but yeah, we do need to get to the point here because Seth withdrew under a cloud of confusion at the time, since some things have kind of shaken out. I was both disappointed in Seth Andrews, but also trying to find a place to see his point of view. There are people I think who might be inclined to say, oh, well, you know, Seth was a dick and he did this dick move and everything else is apologia. And I'm like, well, we're not talking about a discussion between Christians and atheists here. We're talking about individuals, contractual agreements, expectations. You know, as I put it to a friend of mine, I don't have a problem with Seth pulling out because let's say one were a carpenter and they showed up to the job site and the boss was like, okay, get to work, and it's all plumbing. And the person goes, yeah, I'm a carpenter. And then the other person goes, what are you, lazy? What's wrong with you? And it's a little like, no, that's not the point. I mean, Seth as an individual has every right to pull out of a convention or pull out of a situation if he feels as if it's going wrong. And even if he wants to shy away from the culture discussion, because Skeptic and Shu didn't really touch on it as hard, but Sargon and Melissa Chen, and to some small extent, Faisal and Asra, were talking about the sort of, I think, the idea outside of the movie. MythCon was kind of about defending Western culture and Enlightenment, classical liberal values that built Western culture, and how that those things are kind of under attack from a lot of directions. Seth Andrews didn't, or Aaron Ra or anybody else didn't anticipate this, and I don't think it was clear to anyone beforehand, because once again, we're talking about an atheist convention called MythCon. So there's already number layers of sort of dispersion. Yeah. And and you're not really sure what the jewel of it really was. Having been to MythCon, and I'm sure anyone who can watch the video can attest, I would say that ultimately it sort of became about, Western cultural values. And now if it had been set up that way at the outset, I really don't think it would have been as big of an issue. And I'm certain that like people like Arn Ra and Seth Andrews could have just said, oh yeah, that's not my bag. Not interested. But I think they had a different idea of what it was about going in, and then were unpleasantly surprised to find out that was not the case.
Yeah. And that is something that I wanted to touch on. And I think it is interesting that we brought up the Western values and liberal values, because that seems like that's the pro that this side of the debate wants to hang their hat on, instead of just being against the idea of this, you know, social justice, victim culture and all that. Because essentially when you're attempting to gather a group of people, you're going to be more effective in the long term if you talk about what you're for, what you're agreeing with, instead of just what you're attacking. It's the pro-life versus pro-choice debate.
Right.
Nobody wants to be the I'm on the side of death.
Anti-life or anti-choice, right.
Yeah.
And there was something years back, and I dismissed her because she kind of was like an old hippie lady. This is in my youth. And I just got tired of bullshit aphorisms coming from anybody. And hippies, I noticed, that kind of thing has kind of gone a bit of the way of the dodo. Or maybe it's been absorbed into something else. But the hippie attitude was something I just found to be revolting after a while. Like, oh, for Pete's sake, like, can you avoid reality any harder? But there was something this woman said to me that kind of stuck with me ever since. And she said, what you're against weakens you, and what you're for strengthens you. Now, I don't know if necessarily what the hell she meant by that, like if you're talking about energy, man, or if you're talking about, you know, something more substantial. But there was a kernel of truth in there that reflects what you're saying. Like, it's more important if you don't know what you're for. If you're just anti everything, well, then, you know, you're at risk of being a nihilist or a, you know, the kind of anarchist that ends up just destroying things. Anarchy is in chaos, not anarchy is any personal political opinion. So Seth withdrew, but unfortunately, if he had just simply said, I don't agree with what we set out to do, and like Arn Ra avoided all the heat. He didn't catch any heat at all, because Arn Ra, maybe because he's a more seasoned atheist or public figure. I mean, Arn Ra has done a lot of debates. Arn Ra is actually, I think, didn't he run for office in Texas?
Yeah.
Did that? Yeah. So you're talking about a man who's got probably a lot of experience with how things go, so to speak. And so he probably knew better than to make any major statements about leaving. Just simply duck out, be like, no, I'm out. And let it swim in mystery. If Seth had kept his mouth a little more shut, I think he'd have been fine. But I would like to point out, and you posted a link to his Facebook, sort of the essay, as it were, that he wrote about why he wasn't going to be attending.
Yeah.
And I have a specific clause that is really the bone of contention that I have with what Seth did. And it's numbered numerically. It's been numbered 5 in his little pointed list of points. And he said recently, this is a quote, I have this actually captured. Recently, I wrote MythCon with a formal request that it issue an apology to Sargon, Shu, and Armored Skeptic for the trouble. And then his own italics, and then withdraw their invitations to speak, giving those open slots to better, more reasonable, and more compelling names like Ron Miscavige. I'd have also supported the inclusions of dissenting activists who had better reputations and a track record of better behavior. MythCon politely declined. Now, this is part of what caused the big uproar against Seth Andrews.
Yeah.
Because however Seth likes to put it, he basically just sort of suggested deplatforming. And that's a hot point for the anti-SJW crowd.
Yeah, and I having talked to him, I don't think he, and especially this is something that Matt Dillahunty brought up in his video, that Seth didn't really realize the implications of what he was suggesting there.
Right.
That he did not see it as a deplatforming. And he goes in, if for the listeners on the podcast, I would advise if you have not read the full Facebook, and as Nick mentioned, I put a link to this, and then I'll put a link to this in the show notes. The full statement that Seth made, as well as the comments that he made afterwards, the addendum to which is included.
Yeah.
You know, it is worth reading the full thing. Both right. for the point, the good points that he made and the bad points, because he's right. still being somewhat ad hominem against, you know, Sargon, Shu, and Skeptic.
Right. And in his defense, while he hasn't, to some extent, he hasn't doubled down or gotten worse about this approach. I mean, the fact is that he had an invitation to go to a particular convention. He was alerted to how three of the speakers were poorly behaved from his perspective. And there is a case to be made for that from a certain perspective, and it's an honorable point. But on the same token, and you can also argue that maybe MythCon was getting involved in something more wild and wide than Aaron Raw, you know, Seth Andrews, et cetera, wanted to get involved in. And that is their right to demur from that.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, Seth Andrews did ostensibly, I mean, clearly he hasn't thought through this issue too well. He did kind of, he wasn't suggesting deplatforming, but unfortunately he was also unaware of the kind of problems that these guests that he calls poorly behaved, the kind of thing they're engaged in, and maybe thinks of it poorly. Like, I know a lot of people think Sargon is kind of just a blowhard, that Shu and Skep are not serious. But they have serious points they're making, but they're making them in, how do you put it? It's kind of like a criticism of Seth, and even like Matt Dillahunty that I would give, is that their approach is kind of, in an analogy, is kind of like Kant's approach when it comes to ethics. And one of the criticisms of Kant's ethics, and I'm speaking specifically about a book he wrote called, well, depending on the translation, A Groundwork for the Metaphysics of Morals, where his goal was to try to build morality from the perspective of reason, as opposed to the perspective of religion, which was more the case back in his day in Königsberg in, you know, the 1800s. I think it was the 1800s. And he basically, the criticisms of Kant is that his morality is, it's perfectly fine and admirable, but it only works if his world exists, where people are more honest, are more open, are more forthright. But the criticism is that the world is not that way, that the world is actually a bit more of a shit show, and that you can't really criticize the ethics or morals of people who are in the trenches of the shit show, as it were, when that's what they're fielding, that's what they're dealing with, that's what they're striving against, and that's what they're putting up with. And that to the limited extent they do take on those tactics of the people you think are bad, it's because they are elbow deep in it. Whereas there is a bit of an ivory towerness, as it were, to people like Seth and Matt Dillahunty.
So what it
and
sounds
while
like...
their approaches philosophically and maybe even in terms of trying to keep their discussion clean is correct, it's like they're two different worlds. You know, you're basically talking about having academics and brawlers sharing a platform when the brawlers do have something to say.
Yeah, another way,
that's
I think.
That's a stark way to put it, but maybe hyperbolic. But anyway, another way
I think you could put it was that the Sargon Shoe skeptic contingent kind of have this thin blue line mentality. You know, that when you are used to dealing with a group of this is kind of a weird way to put it, but the police are used to dealing with criminals on a somewhat daily basis.
Right.
So they are inclined to view suspicious behavior as overtly criminal.
Right.
Does that make sense?
So yeah,
that when does. They when they saw Seth's, not only that one, but the other one, that the I do not think the selection of such a controversial But I do think the selection of such a controversial lineup should have been submitted to each of the pre-agreed special guests to make sure they approved, which was
right.
from point one. The idea that somehow, because he was a special guest, he deserves to be able to have veto power over who gets to speak at the convention, which is another reading on that.
And that's not anything that I've even ever heard of traditionally. I mean, is almost every – I mean, whether you're talking about, you know – model train builders or whomever, that's a distinctly finicky political point. And I know that there have been people in the past who've taken that line, and quite often everyone thinks they're a dick.
Well, and I asked him about that directly, and I asked him, have you ever gotten veto power at a conference that you've gone to over who else gets to speak there? And he hesitated for a moment. He's like, well, no. So
yeah.
I think I did kind of catch him flat-footed on that one a little bit.
Yeah. And this is Bart, and I once again shouting out our podcast. Yay. It just so happened that Ben and I both had an opportunity to be on either sides of this issue and talk with people personally. I had an opportunity to talk to the MythCon organizer at the after party. I must say that there was no way for me to have any serious conversation, which I would have loved to have had, but I neither have any sort of, I guess, social importance when it comes to this convention. You know, our podcast isn't something by any means popular that I know of at this point, which it doesn't bother me. And neither did it bother me that I didn't have any importance at this festival, but I really would have liked to speak to did I say festival? I meant convention. Freudian slip. But I couldn't speak. I wasn't so much interested in speaking to either Shu or Armored Skeptic, because to me, they're well, she makes her points, but she does it with a lot of comedy, and she's very much of a video maker.
Yeah.
I think this was to their credit, for all three of them, this was the first time they ever spoke publicly at an event. They've never, to my knowledge, been on a panel or in front of a formal debate. Sargon has gone head to head, but I think it's all been mostly in terms of video formats.
Yeah.
He's been able to do so from inside the comfort of his own little studio.
Yeah. I mean, Shu and Skeptic made a point of stating that this was not only their first speaking engagement, but their first conference ever that they had attended.
Right. Their first, hey, we're on the bill public event. And so, but beyond that, I don't really look at Shu and Skeptic. Like, I think their foot is further into entertainment, whereas I think Sargon, and he's admitted that he's something of an activist, but his is more, it's entertaining to people, I think, but it's very much more political commentary, and it's very much more engaging with people with different political opinions and views. He's engaged with ethno-status and race realists. He's engaged with communists. He's engaged with all sorts of people on his, you know, on videos that he's done and that he's put on his channel. And he'll have discussions with just about anybody. I think right before the conference, he had a discussion with Jared Taylor. I don't know if he's an ethno-statist or a race realist, but he's somewhere in there. Mr. White himself, who I wish Sargon would have smeared him a little more. Jared Taylor kept, in my opinion, committing both the naturalistic fallacy and and a fallacy from nature, which I think is kind of one of the main sort of bad thoughts that these race realists have. Like, skin is white, therefore it's good. Like,
Christ.
No, it's just of a product. Yeah, well, that's like
it's more peach than anything.
Right, exactly. And yeah, it's actually
not a consistent shade across.
And not only that, but it's a really stupid thing to hang. I mean, and it's also
Carl himself, who looks like the whitest guy on the planet, is apparently like 1/8 black.
Yeah. And, you know, when it comes down to it, a lot of the champions of Western values, like Melissa Chen, she's from Singapore. She's not, by any stretch of imagination, a European. So, but I mean, once again, we could go off into talking about race realism, ethno-nationalism, but that would be another topic. But so I think that from my end, I wasn't able to engage with Sargon because of the chances that I did have at the end of the day, at the VIP after party, as it were. At that point, everybody's just so frippin' tired. Like, they were swarmed by people.
And some of them hung over as well.
Yeah, and they were hung over to some extent, which I also kind of was like, I would suggest the convention organizers don't do a drinking party the night before.
Yeah, that sounds really silly. The night after? Fine. Yeah. The night before? Are you nuts?
Well, I think part of the problem there is Milwaukee. It's having lived there for quite some time. I mean, there's a really funny Lewis Black skit you can look up. Just look up on YouTube, Lewis Black, Milwaukee, where he talks about the way people drink there. And there is kind of a heavy drinking culture. And if you're not from there, like most everybody who went to that speak at that convention, everybody was there the night before. Drinking before an event, easy enough in Milwaukee. People are used to it there. The rest of the world, not so much.
I visited once, and we went to the store. And then afterwards, we went next door to the liquor store, which was a fucking... It wasn't just, you know, a counter. This was like a warehouse-sized room with multiple shelves going up to the ceiling that was full. They had a couple little shelves for beer and wine. Most of it was liquor. Floor to ceiling.
Liquor supermarkets.
Yeah.
And not just like, you know, the entire aisle of just Bombay Sapphire. No, there's like almost every kind of liquor imaginable. Every brand of each kind, from gin to vodka to things never heard of.
Those people, Milwaukeeans, take their fucking drinking seriously.
Yeah, they do. It's deep in the culture. Yes. But so...
I think it's a Norse thing.
Or something. I don't know. I wonder if it's something in the water, too. Like, you know, you drink enough of the water in Wisconsin, it's got enough iron in it or something that it... You know, I do know that getting drunk in the winter in Milwaukee is a far different thing than getting drunk in most of the other places I've ever lived.
but to guide it back, you were talking with the MythCon organizers briefly.
So I talked with, and I can't remember his name. I did speak with Dimitri, who you see at the podium, especially during the problem that resulted between Tom and Carl.
Oh.
And by the way, I would come down and say that just as an afterthought, like, Carl swept the floor with Thomas Smith.
And I think even Thomas, in some of his statements afterwards, pretty much admitted that he didn't feel like he did a good job.
Well, and I think that what had happened, and so there's been a lot of commentary, and I'd like to clear a few things up, because I think a lot of the commentary, especially stuff you'll see on YouTube, I got to come out and say it's wrong. There's been all these different perspectives on it. I think there's a fellow, British fellow, whose name is Uzulu. He did about 10 minutes on it, and his point of view was very point by point, but it was dry, and I'm not one to dismiss background information, the environment in which something is put. Like, I don't simply read a philosopher. I'll read about a philosopher because I want to know what conditions that person lived in, who their parents were. I think it's really important to say, for example, Nietzsche's father was a preacher of some variety. I can't remember what kind, priest, preacher, something. That's a very important thing to know when, in my opinion, when you read Nietzsche, because, I mean, on the one hand, it sounds like an ad hom, but I'm like, no, when you're talking about someone who's got, who's such a figure, you kind of want to know what they're steeped in at the time too, because I think it's important to connect an individual's ideas to the world from which they spring, the world in which they live, and why those ideas are important. It doesn't lessen the ideas, but it gives you a broader context and maybe even gives you a better concept of what it means to be a person who holds such ideas. And in this debate with Tom and Carl, one of the things that never really got put out there was that there was a bit of a preamble to this. And apparently Thomas's side, and I don't know if it was that day or the night before, had given a rather hard time to one of the event organizers. And he even brings it up in the discussion on stage that, like, you know, you made the event organizer's wife, you brought her to tears with your antics, with your side's antics. And so right off the bat, you have to read that as a certain amount of tension that was going on before either of them approached the stage. Now, here's the second issue. Ostensibly, Thomas was there to give an interview-style interaction. He was meant to be something of an interviewer. And he started out with the barest veneer of an interviewer. It was kind of very much in the hard-hitting journalist style of interview.
Yeah, basically, some people say that you shouldn't be speaking here. Why do you think that's the case? Basically, it was, to me, it sounded very close to justify why you're on this stage.
Right, and it's a hard-hitting question, but any seasoned interviewer knows that when you're sitting down with someone whom you may have an issue with because you're ideologically opposed to them, your most important skill is dispassion. And it's somewhat clear that there was no dispassion. And not only that, but if I'm not mistaken, I think Thomas Smith didn't really have kind words with Carl himself up to the point. And so you've got a preloaded fight happening before they hit the stage. On top of that, I know that he's done podcasts. I can't remember the name of them. We'd have to look into it, which I suppose I could do right now. But Thomas Smith, to my knowledge, he's not much of an interviewer. I mean, Ben, you and I on our podcast have had a few interviews, or we've included some people as co-hosts. So that doesn't really give us chops as interviewers, though. And I don't think Thomas,
David and Chris.
Yeah, and Thomas Smith hasn't done much better himself. Let's see.
I don't know if I have much experience outside of. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Being an interview is a very different beast than.
Well, so Thomas Smith's Twitter page says, I have many famous podcasts, many as in what's famous. So right off the bat, you're kind of looking at a guy who doesn't really pull any punches. You couldn't accuse him of being humble. Those podcasts being named Serious Inquiries Only, Opening Arguments, Comedy Shoeshine, just to name all of them. But I'm also famous for nothing else. So maybe he's being a little self-effacing. Maybe I jumped the gun there. I have many famous podcasts, but I'm also famous for nothing else. So he's a little austere in his attitude. But
nice to know that he at least has some self-deprecation going on there.
Yeah. And so when push comes to shove, I don't think he was ready to be an interviewer. So maybe I don't know who you'd lay it on, the MythCon organizers. I mean, clearly Thomas Smith thought he was up to the job and he jumped at it. I don't know if that was how it was meant to be. But then he came out swinging. And
And
people look at it who don't know what's going on there and don't know the context of how that shit show, as they refer to it, emerged. between Tom and Carl. But Thomas is very much at fault, in my opinion, for if you're going to levy criticisms at the convention, how it was organized, whether things were clear or not. I think that you can levy those criticisms at Thomas. Carl, Sargon, not so much. I think Sargon came out pretty much, he's so incredibly consistent with his approach in general on everything that I think you would be hard pressed to say that he did anything he shouldn't have. He did exactly what he would do under, I mean, from a lot of the videos and a lot of the interactions I've seen with him, he detected a note of, past detecting a note. He knew there was hostility towards him and he engaged it. So he's like, all right, let's get to it. And yeah, I don't think that's a bad approach. I think that's perfectly fine.
Well, the thing is, the interesting thing to me is I watched the live stream that he did after the event where he actually responded to Thomas's comments about MythCon before and after, which was kind of interesting. But from what Carl says, he came there fully intended to talk about principles, and he tried to guide the conversation toward that at a couple different points. You know, it's like, I'm not here to talk about your moral outrage. I'm not here to address your problems with my tweets. I'm here to talk about your principles and what you want to do, or, you know, basically what we both want to do with regards to how culture should be shaped.
Right. And the thing is that he was prepared to debate. And I think part of the reason why Carl's prepared to debate is because before the podcast, you and I had a few discussions about Christy Winters and his debate with her. I believe you said it was April of 2016.
Yeah.
And how, you know, I'd say most people's idea on it was that Christy won. It ranges from she mopped the floor with him to, you know, she won by decision or something.
I would say that she had the better, she earned more points. I think he held his own to a certain extent, yeah. But I really get the feeling that he came there with a speech, not preparing for a debate.
I was going to make an analogy. She knew how to rap battle, and he only ever spits written rhymes.
Yeah. he's a poet coming to a slam, if you want to put it from another. Yeah.
He's only ever sparred in martial arts. He never actually got into a street fight. And she's a street fighter.
You know? A very White Tower street fighter, Ivory Tower street fighter, but yeah.
and to be fair to Sargon, she's an academic, and once you reach the sort of PhD level, once you've had to defend a thesis, you're already kind of on the road to being a debater.
Yeah, you have to put forward your arguments and defend them against the harshest criticism. At least that's
right,
the intention.
Right, the criticism of your peers in the field. Who are going to pick every hole they can in your discussion, depending on your field. I don't know. I'm not sure how it is with sociology, but certainly with harder sciences and whatnot, it's the case. And certainly with a fair number of other fields, it's the case. You're defending your master's thesis and your doctoral thesis are pretty much trials by fire. Those are gauntlets you have to run, and she'd run them. And I'm not so sure Carl ever had to do anything like that. So, and not only that, but I think that his approach, I think that the discussion topic in that debate from back then was, is feminism necessary in our modern world?
It was something like, is feminism good for society? Which
yeah,
is
there
a
we
really,
go.
It's an interesting question. And I think both of them, and, you know, Christy, you know, tried to address it as, has feminism ever been good for society?
And Carl was addressing it as what problems is feminism in its modern manifestation as an exponent of popular culture? Because we aren't just simply talking about academic feminism. Carl was coming out of the sort of YouTube Because, you know, YouTube, a lot of people, especially in the atheist community, understand the sort of, you know, atheist versus Christian wars on YouTube, like the constant video debate and how it got pummeled. And there have been wave after wave of these sorts of great debates, as it were, to, you know, pit fights, pwnage videos, whatever, that have happened on YouTube into greater and lesser degrees. And the feminist versus anti-feminist sort of thing has been going on, I want to say at least since 2010, 2011. Like that was a raging sort of theme, just like the theme of atheist versus Christian on YouTube.
And if the audience needs some background on that, I would highly recommend Karen Strawn's videos. She goes into the history of it pretty well.
But there's a lot of sort of feminist pwnage videos, because, and there are too many to enumerate or put in our show notes, but you've got, you have whole, I want to say like 5 years straight of young, college-aged, bright-eyed and bushy-tailed people from your very sober proponents who've been taking classes all the way to like your Tumblrites with crazy hair and a snarky attitude. Making videos on YouTube about like feminism, social justice, etc. And then you have tons of other YouTubers just doing everything from simple snarky shit talking pwnage all the way up to, you know, very well thought out rejoinders and counter arguments.
Yeah, we're going all the way from the amazing atheist to theoretical bullshit. That's right. Kind of where I would put the ends of that spectrum at the time.
Right. And then I can't even remember all of the feminists. There's one woman, young woman out of Canada. I can't remember her name, but the thing I noticed about her video is that she always had different makeup and outfits on in every video. And she was kind of cute, but she was also kind of strident. I found her a tad obnoxious. She was a Canadian girl. She had a tendency to hit every single social justice point, from feminism to critical theory, critical race theory, to intersectionality, to standpoint theory, feminist standpoint theory. It was just, you know, not my bag. I'm like, bullshit, 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 bullshit. But in any event.
How many different flavors of bullshit do we need in this discussion? Yeah.
Right. Let's. Let's like make a taxonomy of the ways in which you can be victims, which also is racist, sexist, and, you know, not homophobic. I don't know what the word would be. Homosexually exclusive, exclusionary, whatever. But so, yeah, or like just, yeah, let's put everybody in little boxes and let's talk about how those boxes are terrible. I'm like, isn't the idea not to put people into little boxes?
But that's allowing people to be multifaceted, Nick. You don't realize this? That's right. We're not putting people into groups. We're allowing them to have more groups.
right. Well, which is what came out of the debate with Sargon. And if you could get past the sheer emotional intensity, there were some really good points being made in that discussion by Sargon. And to some extent, I think Thomas Smith did do a pretty good representation of his side.
Yeah, and he's not stupid. He was overly emotional about it. And it's honestly easier to watch that particular discussion than it is to listen to it.
Yeah. And actually, I think that due to the distance, sort of the necessary distance making of video, like I was sitting in the third row. I was basically, when you see Dimitri, one of the organizers, come out onto the podium and try to interject so that they can have question and answers, I was basically sitting about 10 feet from where Dimitri was standing.
I think I heard you at some point, the audience, actually.
Yeah, there was one point, if you listen to the video, I shout the phrase, Title IX. And it's in response to, there is a point where towards the end, during the Q&A, where Tom and Carl get back into it again, and they're fighting each other. And one of the things that's coming up is Sargon, I think, brings up the point that less young men are entering college, and that he's kind of bringing up the point, trying to bring up the point that affirmative quotas, affirmative action quotas in favor of women have actually skewed college enrollments to the point where women are now dominating in most of the metrics that you can apply to college, like from enrollment to graduation, test scoring and majors in majors across everything, excluding STEM, and that even now they're trying to, in a lot of countries, put in affirmative action sort of initiatives to get girls into STEM and increase their ability in STEM, even though because of society-wide pressures, social pressures, to be more socially just and inclusive to women. I think that your chance of, I think women are getting hired in STEM fields where they apply on a 2-to-1 basis. So there are young men who aren't getting jobs in engineering, technology, math, sciences, et cetera. They aren't getting the jobs simply because they had the misfortune of applying at the same time as a female candidate.
Yeah.
And at least that's the idea, you know, whether that plays out in reality exactly such, I don't know. And I don't know who would know, given these things kind of have to be discovered through studies, so to speak, but, or you'd have to go to the horse's mouth. You have to find out, like, why are you guys hiring so many women in this field now? But nonetheless, he put out the point that young men are enrolling less, they're graduating less. Thomas Smith came back with, at first, like a so what kind of attitude, but then it's like, well, then we have to do something to, you know, his solution was to more social engineering, to institute more affirmative action. And I think the discussion got bogged down in affirmative action, and then someone said, what are the root causes of, I don't know if it was Sargon or Thomas Smith, who's like, well, it depends on the root causes of why young men aren't going into college. And I shouted Title IX. And I shouted Title IX because, well, the Dear Colleagues letter of the Obama administration about Title IX was a little long. And, you know, I'm already sitting in an audience where the security and whatever are starting to try and get people to stop talking. Yeah. So I figured two words is what I could get out. But the reality is that in that instance, if you want to look at why young men aren't making it in college, is because the writing has been on the wall for a number of years now. I mean, the whole idea of young men basically walking into a trap where they're walking on eggshells their entire college career, because at any given point, an unhappy young woman can simply point at him and say sexual assault or rape. And it wouldn't matter if the guy never saw her before. He's going to basically get hauled before a tribunal.
And if she doesn't even have to do it. One of her friends can accuse him on her behalf. And even if she says, no, this was consensual, he can still be kicked out. And this has happened.
And it's happened over and over from individual young men to groups of young men. Like, there's the Duke lacrosse case. There's the Rolling Stone article about, what was her name, Vicky or something. And then the frat that more or less got sieged by people rattling pots and pans, and it turned out that these guys hadn't done anything of the sort, and that actually the subject of this article hadn't done anything, and that she wasn't even available for comment after, for whatever reason, all the way to, yeah, there was a young man who was getting friendly. He was on a sports scholarship. He was trying to do something. I think he was trying to go to school to become a doctor. He was friendly with another woman in the sports program, and a different person called him out and said that he raped her friend or something, and he got booted. So if you want to talk about what are the reasons why young men aren't going to college, is because a fair number of young men, I mean, it's already like a kind of a scary prospect or a difficult thing to enroll in colleges. It's a lot of work. You get rejected from the schools you want to go to, et cetera, et cetera. And then on top of that, just to be disheartened by the fact that you're not going in with a clean slate. You're going in pre-damned. You're going in already under the suspicion of being a rapist or a sexual assaulter. And you have to live in that environment and work and go to school with that sort of tense sort of, I don't know, panopticon, you know? So for young men, colleges have kind of become a little less attractive, and it doesn't, it's a tipping point theory kind of mechanism. It's like, how much harder do you make it for one group to go through an already somewhat harrowing process for the average person? You know, there's a lot of Sturm und Drang involved in the college life. I mean, you know, finals and midterms and how am I going to pay for this? And, oh, I have to pick up an extra job, or I got denied my FAFSA, or I got a crap teacher, or, you know, then add to it, like at any given point, it could all be made pointless and not worth it. And you get expelled with half a degree, debt, and your reputation smeared in social media, so that if you were to apply to another school, you don't even know if you could get in there.
And then even if you do make it through the gauntlet of higher education, if you do manage to get hired, you know, we have the example of the Uber CEO who ended up, you know, losing his job and his career over one admittedly sexist comment, but there was no, you know, chance for apology. There was no, you know, there was no option to pay a fine or anything. It was just, no, you're out.
Right.
Your career is over.
Right. So at which point you're like, well, shit, if I go get a job as a garbage man,
maybe I won't have to talk to anybody and I can actually, you know, try and make a living.
Yeah. Right.
Sewers.
Right. Or, you know, mining coal or being a lineman or doing any of these other number of infrastructure projects that,
and the thing is,
no women really want to do.
It's not, women aren't even safe now. Did you see the recent Marvel thing?
No.
It was a game developers conference where a female described the game developers conference as come see the pretty side of game dev.
Oh, yeah. And then that woman got fired, and then I
over
think the person
just using the word pretty.
Yeah.
To refer to female devs.
Yeah. I mean, I guess that kind of goes back to why I'm afraid to call it a culture war, because I don't want to fan the flames of what's already a culture war by calling it a culture war. But I mean, I guess, what do you do? Clearly, if that's not evidence, if this isn't all evidence of a culture war, all these little points of issue that we're bringing up, and
well,
that as people.
Kind of my point is, if it's a culture war, in some ways, we've already lost.
Well, perhaps. Maybe it's more like a cultural rebellion from the, or maybe, yeah, see, we don't even know what to call it, because, you know, you've got the people on the left who say that they're advancing away from a time when we were more sexist, racist, homophobic, etc., and then calling everybody against them sexist, racist, homophobe, Nazi, which is a most
yeah.
recent one that we've all heard. If not through social media, some of us, I've never been directly called a Nazi. I have been accused of mansplaining in real life.
I got called an MRA on Facebook.
Really?
But yeah.
Yeah. I don't count what people hurl at me at social media just because it's already a knee jerk, sort of format. But in real life, the IRL things is, that's where I get careful, because sometimes I look at these issues and I think to myself, like, oh, well, that's just online. It's not in real life. But it does kind of infect real life. I think it's probably worse depending on what you're doing. Like, I'm certain it's worse on college campuses. Clearly, it's worse in Hollywood and media in general.
Well, this is one of the unfortunate side effects of the culture war, is that we're seeing more and more effect of what happens on the internet bleeding over into RIL.
Yeah.
From people getting fired based on tweets, Justine Sacco.
For the normies out there, IRL means in real life.
Sorry, I'm not a millennial, I swear. I don't LOL.
Yeah.
But what I'm saying is, I'm trying to make the point that the distinctions between, you know, what happens online stays online, to, you know, you're going to get fired over a tweet.
Right.
Even if you aren't a human relations manager or a public relations manager, that, you know, you can get fired just for using the word pretty.
Yeah. 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 Language has become fraught. Like, yeah, you're almost better off if you get a job where you don't talk.
Yeah, I continually feel the pressure at work that I should be more of a team player and more of a, you know, have a positive outlook about the direction of the company. So,
well, that goes back to the 80s. Barbara Ehrenreich wrote a great book called Bright Sided. How, I think it's the subtitle is, or how positivity, or how relentless positivity is destroying America.
But that the book like is one I need to look up.
Yeah, I bought it and read it years back, but it's by Barbara Ehrenreich. It's called Bright Sided.
How positive thinking is undermining America. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And so, yeah, so that very well might be kind of a maybe not the keystone, but definitely a stone in the arch of the current condition we're in today. Because you go back to the 80s, and this, once again, we got a topic for another podcast. You go back to the 80s, you're looking at an entirely different sort of modus operandi when it comes to thought control or attitude adjustment, social engineering, as it were. And most of it came out of like a weird coalescence between positivity movement, the whole power of positivity, self-help book angle, all the way to corporate America trying to enforce behavior more or less for the pursuit of the bottom line. Like, you know, if we have happier people, world-class service, you're going to get more money. And it's kind of created an additional layer of, and not that I'm a big postmodernist, but I do pluck a few gems out of the postmodern thinkers. But Manuel de Landa, in his book On Capitalism and Desire, talks about how as capitalist societies age, the population of such societies become more infantile. And that the reason for this is that producers treat everyone else as consumers, can treat populations as consumers, and are constantly rushing to fill needs and to perform to greater and greater extents to fill consumer need out of competition, to like one up their competition. Oh, they're going to bring you a chair. I'll bring you a chair and a footstool. Oh, they're going to bring you a chair and a footstool. Oh, I'm going to bring you a chair and a footstool and a soda. All of which has to do about selling cars, right? And if you look out in the world, you can see this, that there are times where this kind of rush to comfort the customer to whatever means necessary, whether it has anything to do with what they're selling or not, actually kind of pushes this beyond the customer's always right. Like, we have to literally baby the customer. And well, when you baby people, what do? They turn into babies. Their expectations rise.
And in now some way, you could say that this is an attempt to cover up a possibly bad actual product. That you're trying to influence the customer by, you know, glad handing and giving gifts that are essentially in some ways bribes to convince them that your product is better than it actually is. That may be a very right. cynical way of looking at it, but well, this is not the used car salesman approach.
Well, and it's not wrong in that it happens. You that know, it's, I it's would say easier. there's a spectrum of product quality, as well as there's a spectrum of like people delivering service. But yes, you're going to find plenty of people trying to cover bad product with quote unquote superior service.
It's easier to put a little bit of money into your service and to, you know, kind of strong arm your staff into this positivity thing than it is to spend money on R&D or on actually improving your product. It's much cheaper for companies to go the positivity glad-handing route.
Well, and then there's also just the problem of the law of diminishing returns. Like, how many fast food joints can you have before your market is saturated with fast food joints? And at which point, in a world full of rising prices and greater consumer demand, like, how much better can you actually build a taco? Like, at what point does a taco reach maximum taco-ness? You know, at which point, after which, are you not just swapping ingredients around and putting more burdens on your employees to song and dance, et cetera, to try and increase that bottom line, which may very well also be a saturated bottom line. Like, you can't really make any more money than that unless you start making tacos out of cardboard or doing conceptual tacos where people come to the counter and you convince them, they pay you and you convince them they just got a taco.
Yeah. And
you give them a taco experience, but no taco. How much cheaper can you make it?
This is related in a certain way to the culture war, to the point where the whole taking offense at anything is concerned. The idea that if I go to your business and I don't like your service, I'm not only going to not buy your product, I'm going to not ever come back, and I'm going to go out and go online and put a nasty review so all my friends can see it. You know, and if you called me honey, I'm going to charge you with sexism and blacklist you to everyone that I can possibly reach online.
Right, because you aren't expected to be reasonable. You're only expected to like. And if you end up in a chain of free associations and the woman behind the counter hands you a taco and says, isn't that a pretty taco? Pretty, that's what they call women when they want to keep women quiet, and how women are supposed to shut up and be demure with their hands folded and not actually be aggressive and try to get anywhere in the workplace. Fuck this taco joint, blah, 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 right?
You know, you're sexist. You said pretty.
You called the taco pretty. Was it? Oh, I get it. Taco as in vagina, like clam. What you know, and you're just like, you're dealing. And it'd be, you know, this sounds like a joke, but I've actually heard these kinds of screeds from people before. Like, not people I wanted to know, but people I had the misfortune of like standing near. And it sounds insane, but, you know, the only difference between when you're dealing with this kind of free association, the only difference in insanity between the nutter who is schizophrenic and loses their shit at the taco stand and someone who's at a podium, whether they're a famous actor, actress, whether they're a famous politician, whatever, the only level of insanity, the only difference in insanity is the breadth of their tendency to free associate and the lengths they'll go to make free associations. Like, how many crazy chains of, like, you know, mental jumping a beat do they go? Like, you know, and if they have an agenda, like someone who is in a position of power and trying to one-up someone else, usually it's not a very far stretch. Usually, like, God, what was it? Like, I remember Nancy Pelosi was with a whole bunch of, I think it was congressional women on a stage, and a young man who was asking a question in the audience, he dared address her age, and he's asked her something like, don't you think that maybe being an older politician, maybe that it's time that you step down and let like younger politicians have the floor? And Nancy Pelosi turned it into a sexist remark, and she said, you wouldn't ask men that. When I think back to the 80s and the 90s, when age was a major factor in whether to vote for Reagan in the 84 election. Age was brought up when Clinton was running against Bob Dole, who is rather old. Age got brought up when fucking John McCain was running against Obama in 2008. You know, there was constantly said, we're a heartbeat away from Palin. And that's one of the reasons why a lot of people didn't want to vote for McCain.
Well, if he hadn't chosen Palin, I think that might have been less of a concern.
Well, regardless. So, you know, Nancy Pelosi wants to stand on sexism and say, well, you wouldn't ask a man that. I'm like, are you fucking kidding me?
That is a constant criteria for president.
It's a constant criteria applied to men. You know, it's just you're dealing with it like a woman from the 50s. Never ask a woman her age. And I'm like, whatever. But but said for political effect, and of course, playing out at great political effect to inflame the sex war. So, you know, like, yeah, the culture war is alive and well. So I guess maybe we answered our original question that, yeah, there is a reason to call it a culture war.
But so as we're going to call this MythCon takes a stance on the culture war? Or
yeah, I don't know. What are we going to – yeah, we're going to talk about the A versus A two-hour new season special.
So speaking of which, yeah, we are approaching the two-hour mark. Are we going to – do we have anything on the actual original topic left to discuss here?
Well, I think that the idea was that I went to MythCon and that you spoke to Seth Andrew at a New York Atheist speech. I don't know what you would call it.
It was a talk. It was a speech. Uh-oh. Or, you know, a multimedia extravaganza if you want to go that way. He had a slideshow. He had a lot of cute slides. He does a good show.
There were – okay. Yeah. So presentation, right.
Yeah.
So you had an opportunity to talk to Seth. I went to MythCon. That kind of makes us a little more,
yeah. So
like on location reportery for our podcast. For once, we
actually brought
it back to the peoples, as it were.
To give a little more on Seth's point of view on this, you know, I think that he kind of wants to move on from this whole thing. He does not want to make a big deal about this. And he posted Matt Dillahunty's video about it. And, you know, pretty much, yeah, said in not so many words that, yeah, he realizes that some of what he said can be taken the wrong way and that he may have made a mistake on it.
On his side, he
does feel that the mythicist organizers – in a way, we're acting in bad faith, that they were attempting to use the names of, you know, influential people within the atheist movement to garner more publicity for their event, and not in inviting them to be speakers, but into trying to sell VIP tickets just for the chance to rub shoulders with Seth and Aaron and Matt.
Yeah. I would say, personally, knowing what Milwaukee is like, the sort of culture of people there, how people deal with events there, I wouldn't say that it was bad faith in a intentional way. I want to stand up and say that I think that, you know, this is their fifth con. They're a small group in the Midwest in a flyover city, a city that doesn't get very much press about anything, yeah. You know. And honestly, I would say, knowing something of the culture there, you know, having lived there for quite a while in my life, I would say that Milwaukee is not a place that gets they're not at center stage when it comes to the world media experience. Chicago doesn't even get that much notice. Unless you're talking about crime stats or, you know, if it's related to, say, you know, Obama, who served in the Senate there, you're looking at a part of the country that doesn't have the sort of media sophistication of places like New York, Washington, D.C., Hollywood, most of California, period. At least most of the major population centers. Heck, even the other major population centers on the West Coast, like Vancouver, British Columbia, Seattle. I think Toronto, Ontario is a big media town for Canada. Like, you're talking about places in North America that have more media savvy. Milwaukee is not one. And it's not necessarily because anybody there is dumb. It's just that that's not what happens as a rule. It's like expecting Birmingham, Alabama to have, you know, some sort of leg up on major racial politics across the U.S. It's like, no, it was the site of some stuff in the 60s, but, you know, you're talking other cities have held sway. You know, it's like talking about the early era of grunge music, as they tended to call it, that came out of Seattle. And it's like expecting Seattle to handle it like a champ when really focus just descended upon them. You know, they didn't have the savvy of New York or L.A. when it came to the music industry. So there was probably a lot of hoopla around how everybody handled things poorly. And I'd like to give the Milwaukee, the MythCon Milwaukee organizers, the benefit of the doubt in that they're really putting something together that from a distance and from personal experience, they have understanding and awareness. But I think on another level, they're making mistakes and learning about how to run a big convention in a place where it really is a little more bootstrap. I mean, these guys really did have to pull together more from outside of sort of the media or convention beltway, as it were. Like, it's not it like what the first TAM, wasn't that in D.C.?
Yeah.
Okay, and so then you're looking at, like, or VidCon, which takes place in California at, like, you know, Google Central. Like, in that, I don't know where exactly it is, but, you know, you're talking about places that already have kind of high-salaried media support staff or a media industry. Milwaukee doesn't have a media industry, so these guys are kind of outsiders to begin with. So to say they operated in bad faith, I'm not going to say that it's an accusation by people like Seth Andrews and Matt Dillahunty and whatever that is unfair, or not actually that's, I will say it's unfair, but I won't say that it's malicious on their part to say so. I think that their expectations of what someone who's putting together something like that in a town like Milwaukee, and I'd say the same about Columbus, Ohio, or, you know, Kansas City, Missouri, or Cheyenne, Wyoming. I don't think anything's going to happen in Cheyenne unless, you know, not that Cheyenne's a bad town, but they're outside of the mainstream. So they don't have any vetted professionals. They don't have tons of con experience. I'm sure these guys weren't working 18 different kinds of conventions and then suddenly decided to branch out and do a Mythicist convention.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? They made mistakes, but I don't think they were mistakes from bad faith. I think they were mistakes from a combination of ambition and ebullience, you know, like this desire to really make something big happen.
So you don't think they were being entirely mercenary in their approach, that it was, you know, a little bit of inexperience mixed with, like you said, ebullience about, you know, hey, we can make some national waves here.
Yeah, and I think it, like, if you want to call it naivete, I think that's a little harsh, because having met with some of these guys, I don't think naivete is exactly how I'd put it. I'd say that they're not seasoned. They got big fast, and there's a lot of people who go through those growing pains. You get all kinds of fields, all kinds of situations where you get too big too fast, you make some mistakes that then you have to pay for and pay for and pay for. And I'm hoping these guys don't have to pay for them too hard. I know that they threw up their GoFundMe page to try and raise some of the money that they lost out on, because they did lose out big. Like, it was like 13 grand in the hole because of all the hullabaloo before it. I think that they're doing the best they can. I think it's going to come off as mercenary. But I think another thing you have to remember, too, is that when you talk about something being mercenary, you also have to ask who you're talking about when you put that when you paste that on them. And I don't think Matt and Seth are being entirely fair, because you're also talking about people who, to my knowledge, aren't money bags. It's not like, you know, they're sitting there in their, you know, dressed like the guy from Monopoly with their cane, twisting their mustache and going, we're going to make millions. Like, I think if these guys walked out with cash in pocket at all, I'd be surprised.
On the opposite end of the spectrum, in a way, I think that one point of view of it is that, you know, Seth and Aaron and Matt, in some ways, are really they're kind of small potato celebrities, as it were, within the atheist community. They're kind of riding the second wave behind the Four Horsemen, and you know they don't think of themselves as YouTube celebrities, but they are still, you know, B-list from a very kind of niche sort of, but they are just starting to get, you know, the popularity within the atheist community where they feel like they do have to protect their reputation. And
that's
Seth
fair.
Is still very much, you know, a radio personality.
Mm-hmm.
And you can tell that he's, you know, he's done some larger conferences. He's gone to Australia and, you know, did the tour with Aaron and Matt.
Yeah.
Which, you know, was very popular in the atheist community, and I wish I would have caught that myself. But still,
I would have to extend the same sort of caveat to him,
yeah,
given this debacle that, like, I mean, because he's an Oklahoma boy, you know.
Yeah.
And he's a good guy.
A rather small town in Oklahoma. And
yeah.
He's one of the few atheists there.
Yeah, and he's not coming from. Once again, he's not Richard Dawkins. He's not Christopher Hitchens. He's not someone who's had a career like Christopher Hitchens is somebody who had a career. I mean, he was on television in the 80s.
Yeah.
You know, he wrote for Vanity Fair. You're talking about a man with incredible pedigree of seasoned experience when it comes to meeting the masses and, you know, from pressing the flesh to speaking at the podium to sitting down on Nightline. Like, he's, you know, that's not the experience of Seth Andrews. Seth Andrews is a radio guy and a podcaster.
And Seth still, I really get the impression that he wants to view his audience as his friends.
Yeah.
You know, that he really wants to have, you know, an interpersonal, because seeing him just walk around the room before the event started and afterwards and really making an effort to shake hands with, say hi to, get the names of everybody in the room. And it was, you know, there were probably 50 to 60 people. It was pretty crowded. And you think New York City, this wasn't a big convention center.
Right.
This was, you know, a room on the fourth floor of an office building downtown. And they packed it as full as they possibly could.
Right.
And he very deliberately went around shaking hands, making small talk. You know, he was as friendly as you could hope anyone to be, you know, mm-hmm. And even to the point of while he's setting up, taking time to make conversation with me.
Right.
Yeah. You know, he is genuinely a very nice guy.
Right. And I made a point, like, and I will say this, while Shoe on Head and I mean, there were quite a large number of what I would consider millennial participants at MythCon, and they all spoke to Shoe on Head. They all spoke to Skeptic, and Sargon was getting mobbed at every turn. The guy couldn't fucking. At one point, I was having a conversation with a fella that I got to sort of get friendly with during the VIP thing. And I had run out of cigarettes, and he had offered me a cigar, so I was smoking a cigar. And we were sitting at the hotel, kind of in the outdoor area, and Sargon comes striding out, and there was like a number, like maybe one or two people walking after him, but he was on a mission for a cigarette. And I remember standing up, and I see him walking out, and I get up, and I walk towards him like he's coming at me, and I'm thinking, okay. And then he's like, I'm really looking for a cigarette. And I like pat my pockets because I'm like, what, unconsciously thinking,
yeah,
I just ran out. I literally just ran out of cigarettes like an hour ago. And like kind of kicking myself for not having picked up more.
Yeah.
Because I'm like, if I could have loaned Sargon a cigarette, you know, smoker etiquette would dictate that I get to kind of bend his ear for a minute.
Yeah.
And then I would have had an opportunity to kind of see something from a different perspective. I did get to shoot with shit with him in little ways, but at that point I kind of treated it more like and I'm not going to go too deep into this because I don't want to risk going way off course or, God forbid, do something like name dropping. But in the 90s, I was in and around the sort of underground to sort of just under the mainstream sort of rock scene. And I knew a few famous people, one of whom I actually kind of grew up near, and famous for the time, famous for the day, like not like Rolling Stones famous, but, you know, I'm trying to think of someone commensurate, like up to a point, the Red Hot Chili Peppers, and then they got MTV famous, and then they were enormous. Yeah. Or like the White Stripes. Like this was much later. This was towards the end of my interest in the whole rock and roll world. But I was at a show in a club where right before the White Stripes, just like 3 months before they went on to MTV and became like globally famous. But I literally was at a show where I saw Jack and Meg, and they were just leaning up against the wall, and there wasn't really anybody around them talking to them. And within 4 short months, boom, you probably couldn't get anywhere near them.
Right? Yeah.
But I was in that, not those people, but I'm just saying them for comparison's sake. I was around people of that sort of stature. And when you're around that kind of people, you start to learn things, especially if you know one of them and people know you know that person. Fame starts to do really fucked up things to people. And I think Sargon, having spoken and then gone to this convention, I don't think, you know, he'd ever experienced anything like this before, maybe. But, and the same with Shu, and the same with Armored Skeptic. I don't know if they'd ever been flocked upon, maybe at VidCon, but I don't know if they'd ever been flocked upon like they were at MythCon.
Yeah, I think for the videos I watched, they were recognized at VidCon, and people said hi, and maybe even, you know, a couple wanted, because they were talking about actually signing autographs at VidCon.
Yeah, I mean, and VidCon is such a huge convention. They're also there, like, you're talking about, like, if you want to alphabetize, they're like maybe E or D level YouTubers, and there are A levelers walking around. Like, I'm trying to think of some, like, Hank. Well, I don't know, Hank Green wasn't there, but
there was
famous ones, like,
the fucker that did the air horn thing recently apparently was there, Jake Paul.
Yeah, and Jake Paul is a huge one.
He was intentionally going through the front entrance so that his little teeny bopper followers would mob him.
Yeah, and there's some enormous YouTubers. I think the rotation has changed. You know, PewDiePie, of course, was not there, considered the top one. I don't know if I don't know if he showed up at an event with his name on it. I don't know what would happen to that guy. I mean, it'd be like the Beatles, or a lot of people would shrug because they're all sitting home playing video games, or how it would work out. But
it's hard, you know,
you had an event with Shu. And so to some extent, like, the organizers, they do understand the sort of Milwaukee level of promotions. And so I want to dip back to that and then back to the Sargon thing for a minute. I was also I spent some time living in Milwaukee. I kind of wanted to avoid it a little bit. I don't think I need to. I don't think I'm doxing myself at all. But I was involved in some event promotions there. And there's definitely a weird cycle of, like, going from some underground grassroots thing to starting to unfold and get big. And I watched several different kinds of events that I was involved in the 90s follow this rotation, and then they just flash out. And I don't know if Mythicis Milwaukee is going to do it. They're going to flash out. I hope they persist. But it's very, things blow up and crash really fast in towns like Milwaukee, where all of a sudden they get really notorious and they get a lot of notoriety, and then boom, they go flat and then they end. And I've seen that with a bunch of different kinds of events in Milwaukee, like weird art happening events with, like, music and art. Like, they started kind of underground in people's houses and little storefronts, and then slowly started moving up in venues until they got huge. There was another.
Yeah, this sounds like the Why Not Why Not festival that mm-hmm. hasn't really gotten national attention yet, but it's just starting to, you know, it's not unthinkable that somebody in the indie music scene would have heard of Why Not Why Not.
Right. And so with that kind of tendency, and I don't know why it happens that way. I don't know if that would happen that way anywhere. I'm sure there are things that in New York or LA or, you know, other major city centers where there are things that slowly start to bloom and then they crest and fall apart constantly in these towns. I don't know, but it's when you're involved in it, it's a different story. So that said, I don't think the myth organizers mean, like, once again, I don't think they mean to be bad faith. I think that maybe the seasoned participants, like, you know, Aaron Raw, Matt Dillon Hunty. Well, Aaron Raw bailed. I don't know what Richard Carrier's point was. I saw him, but to be fair, I also didn't see people flocking. And this is not any kind of argument towards. It's not an ad populum fallacy kind of argument, but it was a very different scene there at MythCon, where once again the YouTubers were flocked, and I didn't see a whole lot of people flocking Matt or Richard Carrier, and they were out there. And, you know,
it sounded like Matt was kind of intentionally trying to stay in the background a little bit.
Well, he was out there. Sort of I don't know what to call it, like an event area. It's sort of an atrium. It's surrounded by glass at the Pabst Theater. It's off towards the God, what street would that be? The Water Street side. It's on the corner of Water and Wells, I think. I'm just pulling this out of my ass. I don't even know for sure. But it's the east facing side of the venue, and it's sort of a bit of an atrium, and I think it's like an extra event space, kind of spill out space, maybe when there's a bigger event in the theater, which is more towards the east side of the building, where all the action happened. You know, when you're watching the stage, when you're watching Sargon and Thomas go at it, you're sitting in an audience, you're sitting in an auditorium facing east. It's a beautiful old theater. But the stage is to the east of that. And then if you went all the way to the other side of the building, that's where I saw Matt and Richard Carrier. And that's where, after their talk, Shu and Skeptic were out. And Shu and Skeptic were being mobbed constantly. And I think it really was because there were a lot of people there just simply to see the YouTubers. And
which is weird that they would go all the way to Milwaukee just to...
Well, and I think that the event organizers, I'm not going to say they were naive completely about, you know, the effect that having these famous YouTubers there. So it's like, I don't want to sound like I'm going back on what I'm saying, because I'm not. I think they were naive about the consequences of doing things that way and how they would be viewed by people from outside, like people like Matt Dillahunty and Richard Carrier. I don't think Matt and Richard Carrier, I didn't bring up the fact that they weren't flocked in any sort of a butthurt kind of way, because I'm sure that, you know, if it had been more of an event of that stature, honestly, I don't know if that many people would have shown up to MythCon. And I think that there is a sort of a fight to survive kind of approach that you have to have when you're in a smaller town with a new conference kind of thing you're trying to get going. Yeah. And you might misstep into moving towards popularity over rigor or austerity or whatever it would be that you would call what Matt and Richard Carrier want to have for that kind of convention. I think that's more. So I don't know. I think it was a good event. I don't think it was what any particular person would want to say it was supposed to be, because I'm not sure that these guys. It was a bit more of a melange of purposes that maybe don't jive together, and that's part of the growing pains of having an event like this.
So and do you I'm know sure, what the actual attendance numbers were?
Well, let's see. I would say I'd like to do a ballpark if I can look at, let's see, Pabst Theater, Milwaukee capacity. Let's see what it is. Google says 1,279. Let's see. Oh, well, then there's a Pabst Theater Wikipedia that says a Pabst traditional proscenium stage theater with two balconies for a total capacity of 1,339 people. It hosts approximately 100 events per year, blah, blah, blah. But so if it could hold 1,339 people, I would say from my experience in holding events, you can never judge based on, like, if you have a theater event, especially with the many different kinds of speakers they had, and the fact that they had sort of a different schedules of event passes that you can say for certain. I would say their total attendance probably did approach about 1,400. The theater was never packed. There were always seats empty, but I also think there was a rotation throughout the day of people. I know there were people who probably came to see the movie who didn't show up in the morning to see Shu and Skeptic. I know there were people who probably sat in on Sargon and Thomas that didn't give a rat's ass about Faisal and Asra. I'm sure there was vice versa. I sat in on everything, and I did kind of tend to notice there were slightly different constituencies. Like, there were a lot of the main same people. I saw a lot of similar faces and kind of similar types of people there in each event. But I would say that I also saw some variations. I tended to see a lot more older folks and maybe, you know, temporary attendees. Maybe people didn't want to be at an all-day event. They just like, oh, I want to go see Faisal and Asra and Matt Dillahunty. And so they maybe bought the smallest ticket, showed up for that event, were there for 2 hours and bailed. I'm sure there was a lot of that. The all-day event people, I don't know. But I would guess that they got somewhere around 1,400 people or more. Could have been more. It's really hard to guesstimate when you're talking about an event that has, like, so much flux. I'm sure there were a lot of people who left too. The VIP party afterwards, like I paid for the VIP ticket kind of with an opportunity to talk to the people I wanted to speak to, but also mostly because I saw it as an opportunity to give to the event. You know, like I'm not really taking everything I took from the event was freely offered. Like, it was free like speech, not free like beer. So I wasn't taking anything they had to pay extra for the more I took. So I just thought, why not go there all day? I have the day, and the VIP ticket was a little pricey, but I thought, you know, it's a good way to show support for this kind of an event. I can't imagine spending that kind of money on anything else. I can't remember. I think I paid $175 or something like that. I can't remember the exact amount I paid. It was over a month ago. And I just pinched my nose and paid it. I don't go out much and I don't pay for events like this, but I figured, you know, if I am interested in this sphere, this field, I should drop the coin so the event can happen. You know, it's kind of like giving back to the community approach.
I wouldn't pay that
to go see music unless Tom Waits just did a tour.
I would rather see this kind of event succeed than the success of people who want to shut it down, especially when I don't think I've mentioned this on the podcast before, but it does seem, well, I was at Seth's talk. There was another gentleman there who's trying to promote a new, well, I think I've mentioned on the podcast before that I live in the New York City area. So I don't think that's particularly, but
I don't basically think you're too doxable.
It's a big city.
It's like millions. Yeah.
So the idea of kind of reviving the Atheist Conference in a bigger way and trying to get back to its roots of the original TAM and not this focus on special interests or marginalized minority groups, but, you know, bringing the secular community together again to focus on issues of you know, freedom from religion, of the wall of separation between church and state, that these are much more important and necessary issues in our current political climate than sexist air conditioning and whether or not the word pretty is sexist. You know, we are, in my mind, we are facing serious situations of will secular society survive in America? I know that may seem a little extreme.
Yeah.
But considering, you know, we have the left supporting some Muslim extremists, and we have, you know, Trump, who arguably is not religious at all, feeling that it's necessary to essentially pander to the religious right. I don't feel safe at all in America remaining a solid secular country. So.
Yeah, we are. Well, I'm not entirely worried about it. I think that, honestly, I think the bigger threat, if we're going to talk about that kind of thing, like I do, like, you know, as I've said in the past, I'm a bit more of an agnostic. I'm not so much worried about what people believe as much as I'm worried about the sort of shrinking sphere of tolerance. The
Yeah.
sort of, hey, you go ahead and think what you want, I'll think what I think, and we'll get along. Like, I suppose secularism in the broadest sense, but past even just secularism, I'm worried about, like, maybe the problems emerging from ideology. Because while religion does definitely have some downsides, and if you're from an atheist perspective, you could even believe all downside, it's bad in every way. I also think that there's something that at times can be very benign, and by benign, I mean in like terms of a tumor, not really harmful, just a pain in the ass, maybe. But I do think that there are problems that you can have from secularism when you start talking about ideological crises, because I don't entirely hold with the argument that, like, I know that, like, there's been enough number of atheist arguments that, like, you know, pretty much you can find religion at the root of all warfare, and they debunk the idea that Hitler was a communist or that Stalin was entirely a communist. But I think that's kind of somewhat beside the point. I think the real problem is more along the lines that people, in and of themselves, when they start aligning over any issue, and I think you can have a wholesale secular fight. Maybe it won't result directly in any kind of warfare the way you may have seen in history with religion, but I think that you can end up with the preconditions for all kinds of catastrophe. That can come from internecine secular warfare. And I don't think, I'm not trying to turn Mythicist Milwaukee into some microcosm of what I'm saying, but to some extent, I think you do have to be very wary of secular ideologies going to battle. I think it can be terrible for society, and I think that we're more at risk of
Well,
that today.
I
And
think
that if
any ideology is going to battle is a dangerous thing because, generally, ideological people are people that are convinced that they're right. I guess it was a C.S. Lewis that, when people who I forget the exact quote, but I was listening to this earlier today, that if you are living under an ideological government or an ideological organization, they will go after you night and day. They will not let up because they believe what they're doing is right. Whereas if someone is, just being mercenary or is just being vindictive, they might rest sometimes, but the ideological purist never will.
If it's C.S. Lewis, I'm not sure, because I'm thinking of something that sounds like Jonathan Swift, who basically said that, I think it's from the essay that he wrote from which we extract the quote, "Falsehood flies and the truth comes stumbling after it." And I think that that's a rather short essay. It's not long. It's like a page or two at most. And where he basically talks about he'd rather live under a fucking just a regular tyrant, you know, a traditional monarch, some despot, because despots are occasionally lazy, pleased, ignorant. They don't really care. They just want to maintain power. But the moral purist wants to is the most terrifying, because they want to save your soul at the expense of your life, and
Sounds about right.
they're pleased in your suffering towards their end. because they really do feel like they're doing doing the good work, and that they're happy to see everyone around suffering. And, you know, there's been that kind of, I think Mother Teresa was blasted with that. I think, Bullshit with Penn and Teller, like an episode where they talked about how Mother Teresa actually caused a lot of suffering because that's kind of her bag.
Yeah, that was one of my favorite episodes of their Bullshit series.
Yeah, and so in the very same way, I can also see that happening en masse with various secular ideological purists. Like, that's one of the things that I do have a problem with social justice warriors, although I think they'll melt away as soon as their capitalist largesse disappears. Like, that's often kind of a fact pointed out in memes or whatever online, is that, you know, they'll show the anarchist surrounded by a cell phone and a sports car and daddy's money and a college education. And, you know, they're fine so long as they're ensconced. But these, like, that's what I'm saying. These people could bring about conditions. And there's been a number of people who pointed out, like, yeah, you know, these communist ideologues or socialist ideologues or anarchist ideologues, like, they're the ones that pave the way. But they're the first against the wall when the actual military regime and the opportunists show up to take advantage of all the chaos that these people sow. You know, this interregnum they create between the order they're tearing down and the order they believe they're going to create. You know?
Better to live under robber barons and other omnipotent moral busybodies. Robber barons' cruelty may sometimes sleep. His cupidity may at some point be sated. But those who torment us for our own good will torment us without end, for they do so with the approval of their own conscience. Oh, yeah, that was the quote that I was looking for.
And was that C.S. Lewis, or was that
C.S. Lewis from his 1948 book God in the Dock: Essays on Theology.
Okay, well, maybe I'm misquoting. Maybe I should check my Jonathan Swift.
But yeah, it's kind of surprising that C.S. Lewis would have said something like that.
Well, right, because he wrote the
Mere Christianity.
Well, and I mean, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, wasn't that his thing?
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's pretty much just an enormous aphorism for, you know, Christianity. I watched that for shits and grins on Netflix, the Narnia thing, and I'm like, okay. And then, like, you know, it's painful, like, you know. Aslan gets killed according to the old laws on the big stone temple, but then as soon as he resurrects and the stone temple cracks, it's like, yeah, right, because Christ was the ultimate sacrifice, no longer needing to have sacrifices because he saves humanity, blah, 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 with his sacrifice.
I would watch it again just for Tilda Swinton as the White Queen.
I mean, you know. Jonathan Swift, Falsehood Flies. There we go. Jonathan Swift, Falsehood Flies. And, the quote. Maybe he had an essay on political lying. Maybe that's what I was looking up. Let's just take a look at that. 1667 to 1745. It is. It's a couple pages. Let's see if I can find. He says something kind of similar here. The superiority, he's talking about political liars. The superiority of his genius consists in nothing else but an inexhaustible fund of political lies, which he plentifully distributes every minute he speaks, and by unparalleled generosity forgets and consequently contradicts the next half hour. He never yet considered whether any proposition were true or false, but whether it were convenient for the present minute or company to affirm or deny it. So that if you think fit to refine upon him by interpreting everything he says, as we do dreams, by the contrary, you are still to seek and will find yourself equally deceived, whether you believe it or not. The only remedy is to suppose that you have heard some inarticulate sounds without any meaning at all. And besides, that will take off the horror you might be apt to conceive at the oaths, wherewith he perpetually tags both ends of every proposition. Although at the same time, I think he cannot with any justice be taxed with perjury when he invokes God or Christ, because he hath often fairly given public notice to the world that he believes in neither. So he's actually talking about political liars. So yeah, I think you're the one who I'd have to read this again. It's a tough read, but it's short. It's really good.
The falsehood flies, the Jonathan Swift, but the C.S. Lewis, I misattributed that. So, but we're far flung. What's the time? How long is our recording?
We are over 2 hours at this point. So okay. I might have to trim just a little bit so I can split it to 2 hours. But did you have anything else that you felt was relevant to the?
No. I think that's it about the reports to MythCon Milwaukee. I think so much else you can hear from the mouths of the various horses, you know, the people who were in attendance, who were speaking there or who had something to do with it. Everyone from Sargon to Richard Carrier have spoken up about it. If you peruse on the internet, you can find many neat quotes and many interesting perspectives on it. I think at the end of the day, it was a good thing. I don't think it was a good thing for all. I think some good things came out of it, even though it seemed contentious and terrible. I hope the MythCon guys do it another one next year. I hope that people over time can sort of forgive some of the stuff. I think Seth Andrews, like I said, I think he was a carpenter that showed up to a plumbing job and was like, yeah. Wait a minute. This isn't my bag.
And I don't like to attribute malice on either side, but yeah, it seems like there was some serious miscommunication and
yeah.
I honestly, I hope all people involved can kind of move on from this to bigger and better things.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, Matt Dillahunty put it well when he said, unless they change things, I will not be going to another one. And I think that's a fair statement. And I think that maybe at best, maybe Mythicist Milwaukee might return to their mission statement. They might pull back from all the criticism, sit down, take a look at what they're doing and say, okay, we need to clarify where we stand. Maybe we need to get rid of some of this. Their name, Mythicist Milwaukee. I mean, among hardcore philosophical atheist types and whatnot, they've already got their kind of foot in a bind because they got a brand name now. They're known as Mythicist Milwaukee, and mythicism is a particular thing, which they can't say they are anymore. But, you know, I mean, that was just a byproduct of circumstance, you know, like, you know, picking a name is tough. So past that, even though I think they're going to have to kind of sew together their mission statement, maybe revise it, clean out some discontinuities and some things that they want out of it or what they're trying to achieve, maybe try to clarify that a bit more. Maybe that'll help in the future when they're getting guests and trying to promote an event. I also think they would do well to avoid, and if they're listening to this, I'd say do well to avoid any downtown spaces, whether you stay in Milwaukee or move somewhere else. Downtown spaces in cities, medium-sized cities, are often the kind of they already suffer from all the problems of a major kind of financial district, and that parking is expensive, and you know, the convention center circuit, those things are expensive. There are lots of ways that you can have an event and you don't have to make a big hue and cry out of it. A lot of people will still show up. You know, spending a lot of money on an event does not make the event better or bigger.
Yeah.
I know that town enough to know there are other venues where if you've got people coming from all over the place, they're still going to show up. maybe you're considering proximity to hotels, but you might also just want to consider, like, is this an event space that, like, there are theaters that will hold these events too. They don't necessarily, I can think of a number of places in that town that'd be just perfectly fine. But, you know, taking the probably one of the most prestigious downtown theaters in the town, you might reconsider that, because, you know, you're, whenever you bring it together a conference, your attendees are already pulling hard on their bank account. You know, you might want to consider something that, if you really want more people to attend, you might want to consider kind of a broader venue that isn't as expensive, maybe. I don't know. I don't know what else to say about it.
All right. Well, for all of you who have listened to the bitter end of the podcast, thanks so much for listening, and thanks so much for coming back after our break. We appreciate it.
Yeah, we hope that you can suffer through it. And this is we'll try to stick to an hour from here on out. This was our new season debut, our 2 hour plus special.
So this is season two of A versus A.
Yeah, we would have gotten Donnie and Marie and Johnny Cash and a whole bunch of other star-studded cast, but alas and alack, we don't have the pull of Mythicist Milwaukee.
Ed Cash is dead.
Yeah.
Well, so that would have been an ugly sight. You can't hear a corpse.
Really, it would have been really expensive to try and get him here. Really expensive.
And he couldn't say much.
Well, you know, I mean, would, yeah.
Oh. Thanks everybody for listening. You can check us out on SoundCloud at soundcloud.com/AVSA podcast. You can check us out on all the other social media sites, from Facebook to Google+ to the Twitters, at the same tag, AVSA podcast. And I forgot what else I used to say in the outro.
Yeah, I think that's good.
I'll have to look it up again. But yeah, thanks so much for listening. I'm Benjamin.
I'm Nick.
And good night.
Take care.